Hey, Bo, thanks so much for being on the show. Can you please introduce yourself to the audience and let them know a little bit about who you are and how you got into real estate?
Sure, man. I'm 46 years old. I'm out of Gainesville, Florida. I started off, actually, I did my undergrad degree at the University of Florida in marketing. Graduated in 1998, went and worked for Trammell Crow Residential for about 3 years, unknowing that they were even a big dog in the apartment development space. I just needed a job. I was working on site at an apartment complex, just doing leasing and property management. And that's when I fell in love with, like, oh my God, there's 800 people here paying for a $20 million asset, and I don't even see the owners. I mean, that's amazing, right? So I got super motivated. So I went back and did a actually Trammell Crow paid for some education. So I got my real estate license. Didn't do anything with it. I just got my license because they paid for it. And when I was getting my license, everyone was talking about the graduate real estate program at the University of Florida. So I looked into it. It had some pretty heavy restrictions to get into it. You had to have a GMAT score. You had to have work experience. You had to have a good GPA. You had to pass this damn GMAT test. And so it took me forever. I had to take it 3 or 4 times. I finally got into the program. They only accept 30 students from around the world. This was in 2002. So I did the program. And that was where I really, really started grabbing onto real estate. I was just getting super motivated, had an incredible board of directors. Graduated from that program in 2002, went and worked for a developer in Gainesville that did office, retail, industrial, multifamily. And I brokered the assets. I did all the leasing, the sales, managed the assets. After a few years, I started helping with acquisitions on the principal side, and did that for about 10 years. And then started thinking to myself, well, shoot, I made this one guy really, really rich. He was already rich. I made him richer. What if I did this for 5 guys? What if I did this for 20 guys? What if I did this for 100 guys, right? And so an opportunity came available to acquire a Coldwell Banker commercial and a Coldwell Banker with some partners. We had about 100 agents. I went right into multifamily brokerage. After about a year or two, I went all in and specialized in multifamily, and just hit it off. Did very, very well, and built a name in the community and in the industry. And then in 2020, I sold back the franchises to my partners. And just created my own little boutique firm, Beaubury Multifamily Advisors. I do anything over 10 units, market rate or student housing, and I cover the northern half of Florida.
Well, that's awesome. You have a very impressive track record, and I'm really happy you're here. I know you're a big advocate and like you're a big fan of numbers and
Oh,
statistics. And so
yeah.
I would love it just because we are going to dive into how to build, broker relations and get deals from brokers and things like that. But can you just briefly, I know you have a statistic that I'm sure it's off the top of your head, the statistics between owners and the percentage of assets owned. And can you just start there in terms of like who owns the multifamily properties in this in the US and how that breaks down, maybe how it's really small and a lot smaller than people might realize.
Yeah. So in the northern half of Florida, first of all, as you all know on this, they're listening to this, Florida is easily top five, if not higher, multifamily markets in the United States. I mean, there's Texas, there's New York, there's California, there's other markets that are great, right? But Florida is undoubtedly in the top five. I cover the northern half, and in the entire northern half of Florida, which is lower priced than the southern half of Florida, that's where there's really high priced stuff, but still a phenomenal half of the state. There are only 1,978 apartment complexes over 10 units, right? And about 48% of those are over 100 units, right? So it's a very small number of assets, but there's only 1,978 total assets. And that's affordable housing, student housing, and affordable housing combined, right? Those 1,978 assets are owned by only 993 people in the world. From real estate investment trusts down to the dying off mom and pop that hardly ever exists anymore. That's it. And of the 993, there's only 405 that own all the assets over 100 units, right? And I could keep combing it down. If I took, I could take the ones that are just conventional and just the ones that are conventional between 10 and 50 units. And I could tell you the ones that are between 10 and 50 units built after 1980. And I could keep drilling down. But my point is that any one investor's criteria, when you actually look at the number of assets that exist total, not even the ones that sell, the ones that exist total, It's an extremely small number. So one of the first mistakes I see investors make is they don't ever usually cover enough of a geography to have enough data points to go after. And out of those 1,978 assets that exist, only between 8 and 10% over the last several years trade per year. It actually used to be between 5 and 7%, but because rates have gotten so low, prices have gotten high, there's been more trades. But still, even then, there's only between 8 and 10%. As a matter of fact, 10% doesn't even happen in any kind of normalcy. It's usually around 8%. For instance, in 2021, which was the most traded number of assets in the history I've been in the business, there might have been something before in the last 20 years. In the last 20 years, there were only 160 sales total over 10 units, affordable, student, and conventional combined in the entire Northern half of Florida, 160. All right, so we're talking like 13, 14, 15 deals a month, right? And then if you're a guy who only buys over 100 units, it's less than that. If you're a guy who only buys something that's older than 19 or younger than 1980, but not brand new, it's even smaller. And if you're someone who, you know, needs at least $5,000 or $6,000 a unit value add in order to even look at it, it gets less. And so my point is it just gets lower. And I have found that any one investor, there are only between one and two sales per month in the entire northern half of Florida that you could even have a shot at, that fit your criteria, that you would go after, that you would know about, right? So I'll have some investors call me and, that are like in Jacksonville to say, hey, Bo, I'm in Jacksonville. You know, I'm very successful in this line of business, but in real estate, I'm looking to get started. You know, I've got $2 million to invest. I'm looking to stay in Jacksonville because I know this market. And then I start riling off the stats of how few number of sales happen in just Jacksonville. And they're like, oh my God, right? Which is why the best investors in the world, the ones I write about in this book, they're covering entire states. They're covering entire geographic regions, the Southeast, because they have to have enough sale data points that based on the market share they believe they can capture equals a number of deals they want to do.
Yeah, no, that's so important. And I completely agree. I think I agree that it's kind of there's just balance between being in enough markets that you can understand them well, and then also, you know, not being in too little where you have enough transactions.
Exactly
happening.
Right.
So I'd love to know, because I know you always emphasize the importance of understanding the market like the back of your hand, especially when it comes to not only, you know, being a savvy investor, but building that relationship with the broker. Can you kind of dive into how we should balance that and how we should approach that by, you know, how we should pick enough markets, but also have enough, not too much, so we get overwhelmed and not understand the
sure details. So, you know, I'll talk about this from a broker standpoint, which is almost equivalent to an investor standpoint. The reason I cover the northern half of Florida is because when I started off in this business, my coach and I have a commercial real estate coach. Mm. We audited my business and my markets. And of course, being based in Gainesville, we started off and said, okay, well, how many sales happen in Gainesville? Okay, well, there's only about 12 to 14 sales that happen total the entire year. Okay, and about four or five of those, I'll never have a shot at because I'm not an institutional broker, right? I'm not going to be able to sell the $110 million student housing asset. That's usually not my genre, right? Okay, well, I got to expand. So then I look at Ocala. Okay, Ocala only does six or seven assets. And so I just kept, and the way I get this data is, I always use tax assessor websites. Tax assessor websites are the only true data that have every asset and every sale on the market because they want to tax you. In fact, CoStar and all these other websites that you pay for, that's where they get their data from. They just mine it in a way in which is easy to read so they can sell it to you. If your tax assessor website does not have the ability to export this kind of data, then you do have to pay for a CoStar, a Reese, or whoever, right? But you're looking for enough number of data points. For me, there's 160 sales, right? And so if there's 160 sales, I try to capture anywhere between 12 and 15%, which is a pretty dominant number of transactions, right? I want to be able to do, I can only handle myself with my one assistant and farming out other stuff. I can only handle 12 to 15 deals a year, right? Some of the big brokerages who have a two-person partnership with three juniors under them and an analyst staff, a heavy, heavy, heavy hitter might be able to do 20 or 30 deals a year, right? But I needed to cover enough markets that if I could capture 10%, which I believe to have been believable, that's what I'm looking for. For you, it's even more competitive. You have to cover a larger area because in my northern half of Florida, there's only about 60 multifamily brokers. That's it. And the 80-20 rule, which is exactly right for this one, there's only about 12 of us that are actually doing most of the deals, right? For you as an investor, you're competing against tens of thousands of people for those 160 closings, right? So your market share that you're after is much less, okay? 2 or 3% in a region is pretty damn good. You'd be a heavy hitter. Think about if you're actually capturing 2% of all of Florida.
Yeah.
Right. There's probably a good 500 or 600 transactions that happen in the southern half of Florida. I'm just guessing. I've never covered it. Right. But if that was 700 transactions total and you were capturing 2% of those, that's pretty damn good. Right. If you were doing 14, 15 deals a year. And most of these guys are covering multiple states.
I appreciate you clarifying that. And, you know, you keep talking about the importance of brokers and the role they play. And I mean, we of course understand that. And you're always, you know, quick with the fact that I believe it's, I want you to name the specific fact, the statistic, but it's over 90% of transactions in the multifamily space happen with a broker. Can you provide some more context into that just so people understand? Because a lot of people in the audience might be coming from a single family background where it's feasible to go direct to seller. And so is that a feasible option? And if not, why not?
Right. Now, great question. So a lot of times when I describe that it's true, and of every deal over 10 units, I did a 5-year study where I studied 31% of every transaction. I didn't show you all the transactions, it would have taken even longer. I studied 31% of the transactions over a 5-year period, literally called all the owners, brokers, and asked them which one had a broker involved in it. And 92.55% of every deal done was done by a broker. A broker was involved, right? Whether they were selling off market to their database or it was on a website or whatever it was handled by a broker. Not because brokers are amazing or whatever. It's just because if you think about the mentality of the guy who owns a 50 unit complex, why would you entertain some random human being named Kerwin calling him on the phone and saying, hey, my name's Kerwin. I see your 50 unit complex in Daytona Beach. I'd like to make an offer. And he sells it to you. Why would he do that when he can hire me? And in 2 weeks, I'll have a marketing package. And then 2 weeks later, 4 weeks total, I'll have him 15 offers. And then I'm going to make those 15 guys bid against each other and do a best and final and then reach a price that he couldn't even dream of. Why wouldn't you do that? It's not like it's 6 months to sell an owner-occupied office building like some commercial real estate guys. Everybody wants investment-grade property, right? So the whole point or a major part of my book on the multifamily investors who dominate is, listen, if you're trying to be the most efficient and effective with your time and make the most amount of money in a narrow period of time, it's working with brokers. You can try to be hard-headed and write the perfect letter to a seller who gets your letter on the perfect day. Maybe the husband or wife died and the other spouse inherited some property. They've been managing themselves for 2 months. They're pulling their hair out. I'm not for this business. I just want to get rid of this thing. And they read a letter from Kerwin and, oh, I should call this Kerwin guy. You can try to be that investor and you will get a couple. You will just do far, 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 far less deals than the guy who only concentrates on calling every single broker in the market on a repetitive 30 to 45 day cadence and building that relationship. So they send it to you before it even starts getting marketed, right? That's the whole world here. And it is done by brokers because it just makes sense to do so. And you're right. The ones who come into this business from single family, duplexes, quadruplexes, eightplexes, that is a residential realtor or residential product. Still, the majority of those deals are done by realtors, but there's far more likelihood of a buyer calling a seller directly and doing a deal because the people who own those kinds of assets, they don't do this for a living. It's not like it's not something they're entrenched in. They don't know how unbelievably desirable their product is to the world. Okay. But over 10 units, I mean, 20 unit complexes are wanted by someone in Russia right now. I get calls from Russia, Israel, Japan, United States, India, all of these investors will buy 20, 40, 50, 200 unit complexes in tertiary markets. That's how desirable these are.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I completely agree. I mean, I know that it's so important to have those relationships with the broker. And you said have that cadence where you're following up with them 30 to 45 days, every 30 to 45 days. And we use Podio for our CRM. We're very religious with it because of the book that we read, your book. And we are, you know, we just treat it like a sales funnel almost. You know, you're just following up with people and building those relationships.
But you have to have a CRM or something. You can't use an Excel spreadsheet. Don't use freaking Outlook, okay? You have to have a system that you import every single broker into. And by the way, it's not just brokers. Import every mortgage broker, every attorney, every appraiser, everyone who touches an apartment complex, you're importing them into your CRM and you're creating a call cadence. Literally for every human being in your system, you're going to call them every 30 to 60 days and keep touch with them. You're calling attorneys, you're calling appraisers, and hey, what are you working on? Anything you hear about, whatever it is. And with brokers, anything you're working on, anything I can turn in a letter of intent on, anything you're doing a BOV on. And you're also building that personal relationship. As you can imagine, Kerwin, over the last 22 years I've been in this business, there have been guys calling me, and there's very few of them, elite investors are a very few percentage, have been calling me every 30 to 60 days for 10, 15 years. And we talk about wives and kids and hobbies and what we did on the weekend. And sometimes we do things together. Who do you think I think of the second I get a call from a seller wanting to list his asset? I'm thinking about the guy who built a relationship with, who, by the way, is a killer. He always shows up to closing. He pays the best price and terms. He doesn't retrade and all the things I talk about in the book.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And Rich, briefly, can you kind of explain what a CRM is and maybe a few good options just real quick?
Sure. So customer relationship management software. It is a software where it has several different categories. You can have personal contacts. You can have real estate comps. You can have a broker database. You can have a property database that lists every single asset in your market. You can have lease comps, sales comps, vendors. It basically is a house for all of the people that you know. It has their contact information, their phone numbers, email addresses, notes about them. You can have their picture on there. You manually input conversations you've had so that you can remember them. But the most powerful thing besides tracking the history you've had with people is the ability to schedule repetitive calls with them, right? So when I walk in on my CRM every single morning, Kerwin, I pull up my to-do list. My to-do list shows me all of the phone calls I have to make and things I have to do in my personal life based on entries I put into it last week, last month, 10 years ago. 10 years ago, I could have talked to Kerwin, who owns 76 units in Tallahassee, and Kerwin told me, Bo, I love you, brother. I want to keep hearing from you every single month. You share good information with me, but for XYZ apartments, you don't have to call me until 2027 because we bought this in the ABC fund and I promised in my prospectus, we can't sell it until 2027, right? So I'm going to put in my CRM to start calling him in mid-2025, right? And I'm going to add value to him every single month for the next, you know, 3 or 4 years, but that's a data point I entered it in 10 years ago to start calling him at that time.
Yeah. Right?
But if you could think about as you're having these hundreds of phone calls with mostly brokers and appraisers and all these guys, you're learning information. You could have talked to an attorney who said, hey, Bo, heads up, just got a call from such and such who owns 6 assets over in Gainesville. And they were calling me because they were talking about selling a couple of them and wanted to give me a heads up that I was going to be their attorney, right? Boom, I'm going to start ahead and put in my CRM. I should call this guy, right? It could have been an insurance agent. Yep. Who you're tight with. Insurance guy called you up and said, hey, Bo, just gave a quote to so-and-so. They were blown away by how much things have gone up. Might be a phone call you could make.
Yeah.
Right? They might want to sell it. Now insurance is $1,000 a unit, right? Now those are tight relationships that give you that kind of information. But sometimes people give you things that aren't so tight and you just, because you're so clued into the industry, you know that's a date you should enter into your CRM. Yep. But there ain't no way in hell you could do this off of Excel spreadsheets or Outlook or whatever bullshit stuff that some of these old school guys use. It's got to be an up-to-date CRM system. And the CRMs are only as good as you use them. If you aren't constantly taking notes on the calls you make, inputting in future calls, taking notes about future dates, then you're just an amoeba.
I completely agree. A lot of investors are very intentional and detailed with their underwriting and things like that, but they don't treat their relationship side of things like that. And if you lean into it with that intention, I think it'll just pay off. And we're big advocates in your network. We believe in your network will have an infinite return on investment if you give it the time and attention it deserves.
Yeah. Otherwise,
the
problem is otherwise, if you don't have a system like that, you only call the top 20% of us brokers who are getting called by everybody, right? You're just a number. But if you're calling all 60 brokers, so let's say those, you know, you got 12 of them who are very, very good, and the other 48 who do anywhere between 1 and 6 apartment deals a year, right? And they also do office and retail, and maybe a couple of them even sell a house here and there. Mm-hmm. But you think about it, let's just say you had 48 guys who only did 3 apartment deals a year, right? So that's 150 deals, right? In a geographic region that you're missing times 10 years, you know, I mean, you got 1500 deals you're not seeing, yeah. Right? I mean, it's like, it's super easy. And you want to call even the ones you don't like, right? Even the ones who just talk too much, who are annoying, who may be cocky, whatever it is, your job is to be a chameleon, right? Think about how much of a chameleon I have to be. Think about the kind of personalities and egos I deal with on a regular basis. I just try to be nice all the time, build relationships, right? I want to be there for them so they're thinking of me, and that's how you want to be with the brokers. You want them to call you.
Yeah, that's so powerful. And in your book, you talk a lot about that, not only calling them, but I believe you said the highest return on investment for the type of relationship building strategy is meeting them in person. And
that was
a game changer for us. And we've been implementing that. And I want to dive into that, but can you explain why that's the best strategy for building a relationship with a broker?
Yeah. I mean, besides the obvious of, you know, being in front of someone, you know, like when you're at a party and let me rewind, let's say that you and your wife were talking about someone and you have never met them before, but you heard things about them. Right. Mm-hmm. And then you're at a party and you meet them and you're sitting around a fire and you're having a beer and you're getting to know them. And you're like, wow, like what a great dude. I mean, just, you know, and so it's kind of one of those things. When you're in person with someone, you bond in a different way. You learn things about them that you never would have known. You get more personal. You see something. I mean, if you met at the house, you see how they live. If you rode with them in a vehicle, you see their vehicle. If you met with them in the office, you see pictures on their table, diplomas, places they've been. You just learn things about them that you can bring up and create a bond with long-term that you'll never be able to do on the phone, mm-hmm. or at least it takes longer on the phone, right? Yep. Now I realize the guy in Texas can't be driving or flying to Florida all the time, right? But as assets come available for sale and you get competitive on them and you visit a market, in advance, schedule an extra day and meet with a dozen brokers. Even if it's just stopping by and shaking his hand and saying, I'm Kerwin, we've talked several times, great to meet you. I know you're busy. Just wanted to put a face with a name. You know, we'll meet at some other time. I'm busy. And you go off. Yeah. Even that, like it showed, because the brokers, we get calls, emails, text constantly all the time. The people who take the time to want to meet with us, even when we're busy and sometimes it's a pain in the ass for us, I'm always glad I did. I just spent 3 or 4 hours with a guy on Monday who doesn't own anything in Florida. He has some success in another state, but I saw something in him. I know he's flying here from a different state. He's spending hundreds of dollars to do so, rents a car. We go out to lunch. We drive the market a little bit. I'm going to do that with that guy, right? And then we're going to create a whole different bond. And he's who I'm freshly thinking about on the next deal. And then in between, you're having phone calls, you're doing Zooms, you're emailing him articles of interest that might be to him. You're just adding value to that broker as much as possible. Why? Because no one ever adds value to brokers. They just call up and say, do you have something I can buy? That's all they do all day long. But the guy who sends me an article, who texts me something cool, who calls me about something funny, I'm a huge car nut. Maybe he called me about some car that he heard just sold, you know, or he saw on a website. Like whatever it is, or he's telling me about amenities that are driving up rents. He's telling me about a sale that occurred that hasn't even hit the public records yet that I'd like to know about. Adding value. That's who the brokers are going to think of.
Yeah. And in the book, you talk a lot about that, about sending content and kind of putting them on a drip campaign. And that's something that we honestly struggled with at first, because we didn't want people to send people irrelevant topics and irrelevant content that they don't really care about, specifically brokers. So what is your advice to an investor who may want to send valuable information to brokers, but through email or putting them on some kind of newsletter or something like that?
Yeah.
What approach should they take to that?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I would get all over social media, right? Because all brokers are on social media as well. And, you know, commenting on brokers' postings are easy things to do, right? Just take 10 minutes of your day and just do a bunch of commenting and congratulating and so forth. I mean, brokers are like any human being on earth. We all want to feel important and we want to have congratulations and we want to be acknowledged. This is nothing new for a broker or any human being, right?
Yep.
Social media is easy. Posting things. I'm a big believer in putting out content that can be read or understood in 10 seconds or less. I am against 20 page reports, newsletters that take 15 minutes to read. You know, nobody has time for that crap, right? If you follow me on all my social media stuff, like today, I posted something that was a quick little stat. It gave you the breakdown between 100 plus units and 10 to 99 units. 48% of assets are over 100, 52% of assets are under 100 units. Quick little thing, right?
Yep.
And it gets lots of feedback. I can see how many views it gets, right? But I'm doing that every single day, 7 days a week. I'm doing something that adds value, right? As long as it's under 10 seconds. Now, for the investors, you could do it through social media to brokers. You can shoot them an email. You can shoot them a text. I would use all the different means. I would call them and whatever it is. And just it could just be something as simple as you could even do a video yourself and say, hey, Bo, just want to let you know, my property managers over on ABC Apartments, you know, we just did this to collect more bad debt. We are having an issue with about 8 or 10 tenants. We did this, just thought that some of your other customers might want to know, you know, we're all in this together. Boom, boom, boom. Psh, send, right?
Yep.
Fucking awesome. I would love to take that, right? Mm-hmm. And send it to a few other close investors who then see you as an authority. And like I told you, it's a small world. There's only 400 people that own all the ones over 100 units. That guy goes to sell something in the future and you make an offer on it. I, as the broker, am able to say, hey, by the way, you remember that video I sent you, the guy who was collecting like 99% of his bad debt? That was Kerwin. That's the offer right there for $1.8 million. That's that guy. Oh, okay. Yeah. I love that guy. You know, it's like, or it could be by email. You could shoot me an email that says, hey, by the way, so-and-so sold down the road. What I heard was they got their rents from $1,600 to $1,750 a month. That's how they were able to sell it 2 years later for $50,000 a unit profit, right? Yeah. I can then take that email, forward it to a few customers who own assets in that market, who now see me as an expert, and they see who it was forwarded from, right? And so I'm just always trying to connect people and share people and because the more people can be friendly and know each other and be a content provider, the easier it is for me to do transactions, right?
No, absolutely.
It's when people dislike each other and don't know each other or whatever, it's easy to just tell someone to haul ass.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. And so I completely agree. You know, we make an effort to reach out to all the brokers in our markets, even if, you know, some might be doing more transactions than others. But in your book, I remember you clarified kind of ranking them based on A, B, and C.
Yeah.
And I would really appreciate it if you could kind of break that down. And I think that also touches on the, I don't know if it's the Pareto effect or Pareto principle that you touched on, how 20% of brokers are doing 80% of the transaction. So
yeah,
if you could just dive into that, I'd really appreciate it.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, every broker you're going to have a certain type of relationship with. And by the way, this ranking system is how I do my customers as well. So as you're making a list of all these brokers, and the way you make the list is you're Googling, you know, multifamily brokers, Austin, Texas, and Dallas, Texas, whatever all the markets are that you cover. That's one way to do it. I would also then, in addition to just Googling, I would, you know, get a list of every major national brokerage. They're easy to find. There's 50 of them tops. And there's about 20 of them that do all the volume. Visit each of their websites, and they have them broken down by city and state and specialty and all that stuff. That's how you make your list, right? You're making all these phone calls. During these phone calls, you're listening for how that phone call went, the relationship. You're looking at the types of sales they make. Now, you know, you know, a rank C guy, which would be the lowest level guy, maybe for you, someone who only sells 300 plus unit institutional assets in primary markets. You're probably not going to do much business with him, but you don't want to not keep contact with him. You still want him on your monthly drip marketing program. You still want to call him a couple times a year for a rank C person, because the rank C guy is in an office with potential rank A guys who do sell 50 unit complexes or 20 unit complexes, whatever it is, right? The rank A brokers are the ones who sell the most of what you're after. They answered your phone call. You meshed well. They gave you a time of day. You liked them. You saved them in their cell phone. They saved you in your cell phone. They repeatedly comment on your things on social media. You know, they email you. You know, just you guys have it. There's something there, right?
Yep.
And so those are the ones who are most likely to bring you deals. And so you want to spend the most time with them. Those guys you're going to call every 1 to 2 months. And when I say call, sometimes it's a call, sometimes it's a meeting, sometimes it's an email, sometimes it's a little social media post, sometimes it's a text, whatever it is. You just don't want to have more than 30 to 60 days go by. Rank B brokers could be as great as rank A. It just wasn't as tight as a bond. Mm-hmm. Bs can become As. And sometimes A's become B's, but C's hardly ever become A's, right? A B guy is once every quarter, right? And so you're just touching it. They sell the types of assets you sell, but they just, you know, they may have said, hey, I only use, you know, I sell all my stuff to three guys. I mean, no brokers usually say that, but a rank B person just, you know, this is not as hot as a rank A person. Mm-hmm. But anyway, these are how you're going to create the cadences in your CRM. So in your CRM, you know, with 25 rank A people, you're going to call them every 30 to 60 days. Then you're going to have 60 guys you're going to call every quarter, and you're going to have about 150 guys that you're going to call every, you know, twice a year.
Okay.
But all of them are going to get something from you every month, something of value, right? And that is going to produce more activity than I promise you'll ever be able to handle.
Yeah.
You won't be able to handle it. And it gets more unhandleable every year that goes by, because you're developing more and more of that relationship and it starts to pay off.
Yep.
It's those first 1 or 2 years where people die off, where investors die off in the intensity of that kind of communication with brokers, right? Most investors are used to brokers calling them constantly. And we do, right? We're after listings. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to tell you a technique that makes you different and unique. I'm trying to put you on offense. I'm trying to have you flip the script and to have it to where brokers fall in love with you. We can't wait to bring you deals before everybody else.
Yeah. And it's that compounding effect. It takes time. It's a slow burn. That's what we've come to realize, because like you kept saying, 10 years, 15 years, it's, you know, in 15 years after the same follow-up every month. I mean, that would just be incredible. But of course, a lot of people don't have that long-term vision.
Yeah. But I would always call in or email or whatever the contact is with value first, right? Mm. I mean, you don't want to call up a broker and just say, hey, what's going on, man? Like, hey, just want to touch base. Want to see what you're up to, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, nobody has, you guys don't have time for that. We should all have time for that. But if you called up and led off with, hey, found this out, by the way, you have anything I could take a look at? Anything you're working on? Anything exciting? Okay. I would make most of the calls just kind of like value add.
Yeah.
Nothing in return. Don't even ask, do you have something I'm working on? Like, you're already on my list. You're going to get my listings, right? Because we've already developed that kind of bond. And so, you know, the more it feels like a friendship, the faster this thing's going to bond and the more those guys are going to think about you.
That's awesome. And I just got an idea. Maybe if you know somebody that the broker might want to be introduced to, you could offer to introduce them to somebody, making connections.
That would absolutely be a great way. Man. Totally. That's awesome. I've got investors that have introduced me to a bunch of different other investors that have led to deals. And I appreciate that hugely. Right.
That's awesome.
Because they thought enough of me to tell someone else about them. And then we did a deal and then I did them well, which then makes the guy who referred it to me look even better.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
I'm just to kind of pivot a little. I went to UNC before I dropped out of UNC, but I mentioned that because I'm a fan of Michael Jordan. And in your book, you talk about the Jordan effect. And I would love it if you could really just expand on what the Jordan effect is and how that ties into broker relations and succeeding as an elite multifamily investor.
Yeah, for sure. So the Jordan effect is, you know, when Michael Jordan was playing, there were actually a lot of news shows and press and media that covered and wrote stories about the fact that they believed he got more calls his way because he was Michael Jordan, right? The real reason is because Michael Jordan played a game off the court that no one even knew about with referees, right? So now when he was on the court, he was almost never the guy who challenged a call, yelled at referees, cussed him out, threw shit at him, pushed him, right? He was never that guy. In addition, off the court, before games, he would talk to refs and say, hey, how's little Johnny doing, right? How is that thing you did on the weekend? And he would build these relationships, right? Or he would sign something, or maybe signed a book, or signed a basketball, right? Or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. He developed relationships and carried himself in a manner in his personal life that carried over onto the court. And so when something was a marginal call, he got things his way because referees liked him as a person. It's just the way it was.
Yep.
Or you could be the dick, okay, who always yells and cusses and so forth, then you're going to get the opposite effect on calls, right? Yep. And so it's the same thing in multifamily and any industry, right? It's the off the court game. It's the non-transactional game that builds the game, right? It's the phone calls off to the side, talking on the weekend, checking in, adding value, right? It's all those things before a transaction's in play that get you the transaction. And then when you're in the transaction or you're in the game, building that reputation, right? Mm-hmm. Responding quickly, never retrading, talking good about the property, saying things that make the broker look good and makes the seller want to do a second transaction with you as a buyer. That's what you're after.
Yeah, that's awesome. And you touched on two things I want to quickly expand on. So first, once you start getting on people's lists and maybe you start build rapport with some brokers, they might start sending you deals. I would love it if you could kind of walk us through the cadence of how you should approach rejecting a deal or turning away a deal, but yeah, kind of advancing and progressing with that broker and maybe not turning them off from sending you future opportunities.
Yeah. Awesome question. So especially in an up market like this, mm-hmm, right? There's a lot of properties out there that everyone underwrites. You probably kiss 100 pigs before you get to one. And even the ones that doesn't work out, right? Yep. But the 99 pigs are normally what the deal is it's overpriced for you. Mm-hmm. Okay. The difference is it's not an overpriced property. You may think it's overpriced because you can't make the numbers work, but it's going to sell. How many assets do you see come to market, whether on market or off market, that don't sell? I don't see any or hardly any, right? They all sell. So it is the market value, whether you like it or not. So when you reply to the broker, that's overpriced or that's ridiculous, or I can't make those numbers anywhere near work, or I don't know why the hell you use that pro forma rent, or why did you use that cap rate? Like, you're challenging the broker as if he's not going to sell it. And not obviously not going to sell it. I'm going to get 15 offers and there's a likelihood a couple of them will be over the guidance, mm-hmm, right? So you just put yourself in a bad position when you try to disprove the value, okay? So if value is the reason you don't want to buy, and there's all kinds of other reasons, yep, why you might not have bought it, but price is usually probably 80% of the reason, right? The correct way is, you know, compliment, and then you're basically, so she would say something like, and this could be I would suggest either in a call or an email. I even like emails because then I can forward to the seller. So maybe something like this. Hey, Bo, thank you so much for showing me this asset. What a gorgeous asset. I love how the annual flowers were done out front. I love the type of material he used in the sign. And man, if you wouldn't mind passing on to the seller, that roof color with the shutters and then what he did in the clubhouse, outstanding. I have no doubt you're going to get a dozen offers on this. It's going to be a beautiful asset for us. Just didn't work out for our return objectives. Please keep me on your list. You know, I'm going to always respond to you quickly. I'd love to be able to do a deal with you in the future as soon as possible. Hell, I'd even love to do a deal with that seller if he keeps taking care of properties like that. Right. So you're just kind of like, you know, you're not trying to like lay it on so thick it's obvious, right? But you're giving true, real compliments.
Yep.
Right. And you're rejecting it on price, but not saying it's overpriced. You're acknowledging it's going to sell. and it just didn't work for you, and you can tell brokers no 15 times in a row on assets, as long as you tell us, you know, in a gentlemanlike manner and yep. quickly. That's all we ask for. We want to be able to give feedback to the seller. And an email like I just described, I love to forward that email to the seller because it's you know, it pushes him up, mm-hmm. right? And then he sees your name so that, again, next month or 2 years from now, when he goes to sell something and you do turn in an offer on something, I'm going to be able to say, hey, by the way, Kerwin was the one who said all the good things about, you know, Pine Cove Apartments.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I like that guy, right?
Yep. That's awesome. That's
a big deal.
A lot of great insight. I appreciate that. It's about time for our speed round. Are you ready?
Yeah, man. Bring it on.
Awesome. So we have five quick questions. The first one, if you could reflect on your real estate journey, what has been a major failure that you've encountered or learning lesson along the way? And what did you take away from that experience?
Oh, man. I would say transacting with just bad people. I mean, just, you know, early in one's career, you know, especially an early broker or an early investor, like you just want to get in the game. You just want to do a deal. You'll do it. You'll do anything, right? Mm. And what happens is, you know, there are still bad reputation investors out there, and you'll take them on because you just want to get a deal. The problem is that their crap sticks on you, and by association, you can create a bad name for yourself in the market. And so early on, I learned quickly early on, thank goodness, that I don't do transactions with guys who are going to make me look bad. And even though I'm just the broker and I'm the middleman, right? I'm still the one who gets blamed because the seller never sees or talks to the buyer. The seller just wants someone to hate, yep. right? Choose who you're going to work with wisely.
That's great advice. Now to look to the future, what are you aiming to accomplish moving forward? And what are your long-term goals for your business?
Yeah, great question, man. I keep it real simple. You know, when I was younger, I wanted to be the biggest, the baddest, have the hugest team, you know, own tons of shit myself. Nowadays, you know, I've made great money for a lot of years. There's several things I want to do. I want to continue to add incredible value for free, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I just love adding value to investors and improving their game. I want to continue to do the same number of transactions. I don't want to do any more transactions than 12 to 15 a year. I like to grow other brokers. I like to help them out as much as possible. And I want to continue to buy the same number of assets I do a year. I don't buy apartments because I find it to be a conflict of interest. I would much prefer to buy apartments.
Yeah.
But I buy office, retail, and industrial in my own little Gainesville town and surrounding towns. I'd really just want to continue to do what I'm doing now at the same pace. Mm-hmm. And that can be a challenge because there's going to be a down market, right? There's always going to be down markets. And if I can just keep even, that would be my ultimate goal.
That is awesome. And I'd love to know, what is your why?
You know, I just, it's a repeat, but I get the biggest kick out of helping someone, adding value to someone, and then responding. If you ever heard of the book, The Five Love Languages, if yes. you haven't, it's a phenomenal book. Okay, good. So I am a words of affirmation person, meaning when you say, Bo, like you did before we recorded, Bo, I read your book, loved your book, implemented it. It's been working for me. I love how you did this, this, and this. That means the world to me. I mean, that's more than oftentimes more than a commission check, depending on the size of the commission check, right? Like, I love that kind of feedback. I love to work on something, provide some sort of content. So for me, it's just continuing to add value, getting that reinforcement, mm-hmm. right? That what I'm doing is right. I love that. I live off that.
That's awesome. And I meant every word. So that's awesome.
Thank you.
You shared a ton of value today. I really appreciate it. But if there was one piece of advice or wisdom that you would want someone to walk away with from this episode, let's say it's a multifamily investor looking to build a relationship with brokers and get more deals, what would that takeaway be?
I would say one of the things that I run into the most, like when mm-hmm. investors are involved in a deal, whether it's turning in a letter of intent or they're already in an offer or whatever it is you need to separate the emotion part of this and the financial part of this, right? And so, you know, in multifamily investing, a lot of these folks are wealthy. A lot of these guys don't have to buy or sell anything. They're already set, right? They're doing this for the game. They enjoy it, right? And they like getting more wealthy, right? And it's just something to do all day. They're good at it, so it's what they do. But as a result, right, oftentimes emotion gets involved. And so when something comes up during due diligence, or something was misrepresented, maybe in a marketing package when you're turning in an offer, you have to change your offer, whatever it is, make a decision to retrade or come up or down on price in an offer or whatever it is, based on financials alone, not emotion. So in other words, if something came up, instead of saying, seller didn't tell me about that, broker didn't tell me about that, you know, that's going to cost me 60 grand, I didn't know about it, you know, we need to adjust the price, or we need to get a credit, or whatever it is. When in fact, that $60,000 had absolutely almost zero effect on your 5 or 10 year IRR, you're now going to kill your own reputation, your own name. That seller's never going to want to do with you again. The broker's never going to bring you another deal again. That's the kind of things you need to be thinking about. Everything that comes up that you don't like, or that is a, you know, is a matter of return, analyze it on return, not on emotion, because the whole game here is your reputation. Yep. The way I'm going to choose you as a buyer, or even choose to send a listing to you, is my view of you, right? Yep. I've removed tons of people from my database that I don't ever want to see. I don't want them to accidentally even get my listing because they're just so terrible to deal with.
Yeah, no, that's awesome advice. And I don't know if it was you on the podcast that said this, but I believe someone said, and I agree with it, and I'd love your feedback on it, that realistically, when you're in, you know, that the due diligence period, the seller nor the broker want the deal to fall apart. So it's really usually ego that gets in the way, because no party really wants the deal to fall apart. So realistically, if there's some topic or point to retrade on, people are going to be willing to negotiate and come to somewhat of a compromise. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely, as long as you're not a dick. As soon as you're a dick, it triggers a little thing in every human's brain, more so males. Females are far the hell smarter than us. It triggers something in the male brain where now I'm in defense mode. Mm-hmm. As soon as you challenged me, or you were a prick, or you wrote one word a little bit wrong in an email that kind of made me feel like I did something wrong, brother, I'm in a corner, and I'm going to defend myself, and I'm going to tell you to haul ass because I don't need your money, and I'm going to go to the next buyer.
Yeah,
it happens every time.
That's great.
If you're cordial and cool and working together as a partnership, and you're doing feel, felt, found, and you're using empathy, the seller's going to be mush, right? He can see that you're wanting to transact, and that you're seeing his point of view, that you're putting his hat on or her hat on, then they want to see that you're working with them.
Yeah. Sounds like that should be common sense, but it sounds like it doesn't happen enough. So it's pretty simple though. You know, it sounds pretty simple.
It's super simple, but you know, it's like you can't even control the trigger that happens in your brain sometimes until you get repetition in becoming empathetic.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time, Bo. I learned a lot, and I know my audience will as well. If anyone in our audience wants to learn more about you or get access to any of your resources, or just follow you on your journey, where can they go to do that?
Yeah, man. Thank you for that. Three ways. Number one, you got to get the book, Multifamily Investors Who Dominate. It's on Amazon and hardcover, Audible, Kindle. It is an inside look at how these deals are being done by the best in the world, period. Number two, my website is beaubeery.com, BEAU. BEERY. Whether you invest in my markets or not, the reason you want to go there is I have a bunch of incredible information that is the type of information you want to master for your markets. And if you can master all the buttons that I have on my website for my markets, you will be unstoppable. And thirdly, I have a YouTube channel that I don't care if you're a beginner or you run a REIT, you will learn a lot of great information on, because it's all, again, inside stuff. And it's called Bo Knows Multifamily on YouTube.
Thank you so much for your time, Bo. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, brother. It was an honor to be on here.
Thank you.